Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Another shocking departure from the two-top format. Today, three guests. David Moore will tell us who's funding AIPAC's campaign against progressive Democrats and which ones it's targeting. Maren Rappaport will tell us how Chuck Schumer's Bibi Must Go speech and the ICJ decision are playing in Israel. And the psychoanalyst Jameson Webster will talk about how social problems are expressing themselves as mental health issues among the young. With formerly solid political support for anything Israel did cracking in the U.S., the country's friends are mobilizing to fight back. Some of that fight is on campuses, but with an election coming up this year, and criticism of Israel's imperial brutality growing within the Democratic Party, its most notorious lobby, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, is raising money and writing checks to defeat what it sees as enemies of Israel. You might not be surprised to learn that many of the contributors to this effort are big funders of the GOP. Here's David Moore of Sludge, which describes itself as an independent nonprofit news outlet that produces investigative journalism on lobbying and money in politics, with the details. How much does AIPAC have to spend, and how much have they spent so far, and what do they plan to do for the rest of the election cycle?
AIPAC spends money in a couple of different ways, and in our most recent article on Sludge, we covered three of those bodies. The first is its PAC, and the second is its super PAC called the United Democracy Project. And the third is an allied super PAC that's called DMFI. That's in several acronyms, of course. AIPAC's PAC serves primarily to funnel donations to lawmakers. Its super PAC is sitting on $42 million in cash as of its most recent filing. And its allied super PAC, DMFI, has nearly $3 million more. As they did in the most recent 2022 midterm elections, AIPAC and its groups are looking to unload significantly millions of dollars spending on Democratic primaries and other contests.
Now, what's the difference between a PAC and a super PAC?
So there's several ways in which the PACs serve to, oftentimes, they can work as conduits to donate funds directly into a lawmaker's reelection campaign. So you'll see everyone from in Congress, Representatives Richie Torres to Hakeem Jeffries to, on the Republican side, Steve Scalise and Mike Johnson will receive dollars into their reelection campaigns that's earmarked through AIPAC. The United Democracy Project is, as a super PAC, is barred from doing direct candidate donations. They're the type of group that makes the massive outside spending in campaigns, buying mailers, video spots, lots any kinds of digital ads, and tons of other polling and research work in order to support candidates. And that is how AIPAC super PACs had such a huge impact in the 2022 midterms on opposing progressive Democrats with millions of dollars of spending.
Before we go on to that 2022 season, that ban on the super PACs coordinating with the candidates, there's a bit of a wink-wink to that, isn't there?
The shorthand is that they're very much hand in glove. Campaign finance experts looking at the field, there are in consensus that the super PACs are working quite in alignment with the groups, lobbying groups and other types of groups that, you know, whose aims they're aiming to support electorally. So AIPAC super PAC is absolutely, trying to spend to reinforce AIPAC lobbying efforts at the Congress level. And in turn, also its allied super PAC with DMFI spends in very similar ways. So you're right, Doug, that there's sort of a shorthand that the super PACs and AIPAC has a proper super PAC, but then there's these other groups are doing the same to bolster AIPAC's agenda.
Okay, so how'd they do in the 2022 election season?
They're called pro-Israel super PACs for short, often. That includes, encompasses UDP and DMFI. They defeated some progressive Democrats. So in a couple of the primaries that were really calling cards for them, in the Ohio primary, where Representative Chantel Brown faced Nina Turner for a congressional seat, spent millions of dollars to defeat Nina Turner in that campaign, which listeners might know about as well. And in other races, Michigan race, they spent largely against Andy Levin, who a progressive Democrat who had taken positions on Israel that a lot of people see that AIPAC was not in alignment with as well. And then in Pennsylvania was a case where the pro-Israel groups spent huge to support a former Republican turned Democrat, Steve Irwin, in a congressional primary against Representative Summer Lee, and Summer Lee edged that one out in Pennsylvania. This year, so far, the groups are loaded up with these tens of millions of dollars, and only so far millions of dollars have been trickled out, but they're making noises in the press that they're looking at up to a dozen congressional races across the country.
So who are their big targets?
The shorthand that everyone will see in some headlines is that the progressive Democrats, who are sometimes referred to as the squad, which you could ballpark at around 7 or 8 Democratic representatives, are in the crosshairs for spending by these outside groups opposing and criticizing the Democrats. One of the things about the pro-Israel super PACs is that in 2022, the ads that they bought did not mention Israel prominently as a topic, or the ads weren't centered on messaging around Israel at all. In fact, all campaign finance reporters were virtually unanimous in saying that the ads were on a variety of other topics, but the millions of dollars from these pro-Israel groups didn't exactly pin down candidates on this issue. The squad members are certainly the first that are going to be looked at by those of us tracking pro-Israel spending this year. And so far, the millions of dollars that UDP has spent this cycle have been on a California House race, the race for Katie Porter's House seat, and spending there to support one candidate over the other.
Now, there seems to be somewhat of a correlation between progressive politics, domestic affairs, and being critical of Israel, at least as far as APAC spending is concerned. Or maybe I should reverse that and say a lot of their targeted spending, which is motivated by their position on Israel, also is going after people who are pretty progressive on domestic issues.
The record certainly lines up on that. So if you look at a couple of the representatives who they sought to defeat in the 2022 cycle, are sort of tagged now as the squad, if one is going to use the shorthand. And Summer Lee, of course, is one of the examples of that. But, also in the 2022 cycle, they spent against candidates like Jessica Cisneros in Texas. The UDP's spending was in line with what APAC had been, talking to media outlets about their priorities being.
So you have an interesting list of some of the big money guys behind this stuff. Some recognizable names, some not so recognizable. Give us some ideas who is funding this war on critics of Israel.
Sure. So in our most recent story at Sludge, what we did was put together the top donors through January 31st of this cycle to APAC's PAC, APAC's Super PAC, and the allied super PAC called DMFI. And together we found that the top donors combined have a history of giving huge amounts to Republican candidates. And these super PACs are going to be spending in Democratic primaries. They're widely expected to draw millions of dollars again, as they did to support the candidates that are generally favored by APAC. And so there's a lot of Republican mega donor money that's going into Democratic primaries that's going to be buying the mailers that voters are receiving, the TV ads that they're seeing, and digital ads that will be targeted at Democratic primary voters. The top donor, I should begin with, Jan Koum, the billionaire founder of WhatsApp, who briefly was part of the leadership of Facebook on the board, I believe, has donated $5 million to APAC's Super PAC. There's a couple of financiers who are...
Koum, is it? Is that how you pronounce the name?
Yes.
He was also a donor to Nikki Haley, as were several of these other characters.
Yes, that's right. Jan Koum is a top donor to the pro-Nikki Haley super PAC. That's called SFA Fund. That's an important bit of context that people looking at these group spending in Democratic primaries have been highlighting.
Okay, and then Bernie Marcus, that's another familiar name of these contributor lists, right?
Talk about Republican mega donors, and he's up there toward the top. So the billionaire co-founder of Home Depot has been sticking with donations to former President Trump, despite all the everything. Bernard Marcus, he and his spouse have just themselves done more than $60 million in donations over the past few election cycles alone to Republican candidates at the national level. Also, he's tied to conservative dark money groups that promote big business friendly conservative agenda in various other ways. And Bernie Marcus is he's in the mix for as Republican mega donors they come, and he'll be funding some of the ads that'll be going towards APAC super PACs this cycle.
Another one of these ubiquitous names, Paul Singer, hedge fund guy.
Paul Singer is another giant Republican donor with a huge history of giving to Republicans, and as well also is now gave $1 million to UDP, which is AIPAC's super PAC as well. So that will likely be playing in Democratic primary races in the months ahead.
So it's amazing. I mean, I guess in the money primary, you can cross party lines very easily. It's not like some states which don't allow you to cross vote in primaries.
One of the things about UDP is, or one of the things about these pro-Israel super PACs is that, yes, they have a ton of different functions in their spending. So like I've mentioned, a lot of it is on independent expenditures, as they're called, which is, you know, ads and digital mailing. But they'll also help with polling. They'll also help with communications consulting. The super PACs, the disclaimer on the ads, that the tiny disclaimer that will run for a Democratic primary, you know, in Democratic primaries and, you know, possibly in other races as well this year, also, you know, we'll say paid for by DMFI PAC or paid for by UDP. And in the case of UDP, it won't necessarily be clear that there's millions of dollars in Bernard Marcus money behind it.
And in the presidential, they probably don't really have any trouble with Biden, given how enthusiastic a cheerleader he is for the war in Gaza.
Well, we don't know yet how the AIPAC PAC and the DMFI PAC and groups will be spending on the presidential. One sort of indication is that the AIPAC PAC, in its conduit donations to members of Congress, both the leadership of both parties in the House have been largely supportive of Israel and the conduct of the war to date. So you see that, of course, from Jeffries as well as other leading Democrats. And on the Republican side, certainly in Speaker Mike Johnson.
Jeffries is a leading recipient of this sort of money, right?
That's right. So the leading House Democrats are among the top recipients of these hard dollars, these conduits donated to their reelection campaigns. And many of them, AIPAC's PAC stepped up its donations, funneled to members of Congress significantly, you know, starting in November, as the House began to vote on large aid bills that would send aid and other military aid to Israel for the ongoing war.
Okay, tell us about Sludge. First of all, the name. Where'd that come from?
Oh, well, sure. So with Sludge, we're an investigative site focused on money and politics. We're a small two-person nonprofit team, and we're interested in connecting the dots between how powerful interests advance their agenda. So oftentimes they don't do that in the light of day with big check ceremonies handing over. There's lots of shuffling between interest groups, and we'll work to connect the dots between lobbying and these billionaire donors and all sorts of corporate astroturf groups that are playing out in Washington, D.C.
And what are you working on? What have you done recently, and what are you working on now?
So, of course, since it's an election year, Sludge is going to be keeping our eye on this topic of outside spending by AIPAC's PAC and its political groups. We'll be looking at what races they do end up dropping millions in and what the ads are saying about Democratic candidates. We'll also, you know, be looking at donations to both sides of the aisle from billionaire mega donors and then also the super PACs that are spending on key congressional races this year in the election season is crucial. So we'll be looking at, you know, Senate races in Ohio, Arizona, and plenty of other states to see what special interests are funneling money through the super PACs, and especially the super PACs that are tied to congressional leaders, because super PACs aren't always just entirely outside groups. Each of the Democrats and Republican leaders in Congress, in both the House and the Senate, have super PACs that are closely tied to them. And they're the ones who are often spending huge amounts of money in elections. They're often the largest spenders. And we'll be looking at the known donors to those groups too.
Which is a way to reward and punish the party members.
That absolutely is. We see that happening all the time and what bills get brought up and which don't and who's donated to the largest arms tied to the congressional leaders.
That was David Moore, co-founder of Sludge, which you can find on the web at readsludge.com. Readsludge.com. The other day, New York Senator Charles Chuck Schumer, previously known as an unvarying supporter of Israel, gave a speech on the Senate floor saying Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was an obstacle to peace and threatened to turn the country into a pariah, and therefore it was time for him to go. For those of us used to more vigorous critiques of Israel, it was fairly mild, and for many of us it already is a pariah state, but Republicans and other mainstream types were alarmed. How is it playing in Israel? And how is the International Court of Justice's decision suggesting that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza playing there? Here are some answers as Maren Rappaport, a journalist who writes for 972 magazine and its sibling publication, Local Call. Maren Rappaport. What has the reaction in Israel been to Schumer's criticisms of Netanyahu?
It got a lot of attention. There are mixed reaction, I would say. It's not only, you know, of course, Netanyahu reacted the way he did. There were a lot of reactions, not exactly, supporting what Schumer said, but understanding it and blaming Netanyahu for destroying and jeopardizing the relation with the U.S. in general and the Democratic Party and Biden administration. So there were a lot of reaction to that. There were, you know, what Netanyahu said, that we are not a banana republic or something like this, and we don't take orders from the U.S. And even Benny Gantz wrote that Schumer is a great friend of Israel, but he cannot interfere in the election, that election is something for the Israelis to decide. But I would say, generally speaking, it really strengthened the feeling that Israel is becoming more and more isolated vis-a-vis the Biden administration and certainly vis-a-vis the world. But, this feeling of isolation has really gone up.
Would the Israeli population generally prefer that Trump replace Biden in November?
In the polls, there was a preference for Trump. Even in the Israeli right, they don't really count on Trump. Trump was really considered here. He was so loved and admired in Israel, and they initiate even squares on his name and things like that. He was really admired. And this stayed to a certain extent, despite all what Biden did in this war and the aid he gave Israel. So there is still an inclination towards Trump. I saw one of the most prominent Israeli right-wing journalist, Amit Segal, writing that the right-wing cannot count on Trump because Trump has less of this historical attachment that Biden has towards Israel. The general public is with Trump, not in great numbers, but I think even the right-wing politicians are not so sure that Trump will be good for them.
What was the effect of the ICJ decision on Israeli opinion?
At the beginning, I think there was a feeling of some kind of victory in the fact that the ICJ did not put out a warrant to stop the war. Later on, I think people really read the decision. They understood that this is, maybe I wrote something, that this is the end of Israeli impunity in a way. The fact that the ICJ wrote that it is plausible that Israel is conducting a genocide is something that when people read really the text, they understood how dangerous it could be. It didn't affect the war itself. There was in the beginning a feeling that maybe this hard wording by the ICJ will force Israel to slow down its operations. And maybe, the results we are seeing now with, the international consensus that Israel is starving Gaza has to do with the ICJ. Government would not have reacted that way if there wasn't this ICJ ruling saying that Israel is plausibly committing a genocide. So I think there is influence, not the direct one. But I think to the future, maybe not far away, it will have an effect.
You quote Ben-Gurion saying in the 50s, shmoom, like UN shmoo-en, right? And then Ben-Gavir just a few weeks ago said, "Haig shmeg." There's a whole lot of contempt, at least in portions of Israeli political class, for international organizations and international opinion, isn't there?
Certainly there is. If you are talking about the Israeli public opinion, it is rejecting, of course, the ICJ, rejecting the authority of international law, depicting it as anti-Semitic. Even the use of international law against Israel is considered anti-Semitic because it disregards what Hamas did in October 7. If you're talking about the Israeli public opinion, certainly, yes. there's no empathy for the international law and its institutions. But if we are talking about, I think, the elite, the people in the foreign ministry, the people in the justice ministry, they understand the possible impact of such a ruling and future rulings by the ICJ and maybe the ICC.
Biden has made some critical noises, but he continues to send Israel bombs and money. Could Israel go it alone if the U.S. cracked down in any meaningful way? It doesn't seem likely, but I guess it's a possibility. It's worth considering. Could Israel go it alone if the U.S. Shut off the supply of weapons and money?
I'm not a military expert. I rely on what's written in the press. I understand that it will be quite difficult for Israel to go alone by its own, certainly regarding the ammunition. It doesn't have, as I understand, enough artillery, shells, and even bombs for the aircraft. It is difficult for Israel to wage a war in Lebanon, for example, without resupplying by the U.S. But I think the most dramatic thing is the umbrella given by the U.S. in the international organization. If the U.S. will, as Obama did, for example, just before the end of his presidency, that the U.S. abstained in a U.N. Security Council resolution against the settlements, if the U.S. will abstain or even vote with other members of the Security Council to call for Israel to stop the war and maybe even have sanction on Israel, I think this is very dramatic. This is very dramatic because even if the U.S. itself will not go to sanctions against Israel, it will allow such a decision by the U.S. Security Council. It will allow practically all the EU members to have the sanctions, not to say about China or South Africa or other countries in the world. This will put Israel in a very, very difficult situation. Yes, you know, it could go on for a year or two, but then I think... I don't want to say the word collapse, but it will be very difficult to continue its occupation, certainly in Gaza, but even in the West Bank.
Finally, I saw just before I called you that Netanyahu urged unity against U.S. pressure not to invade Rafah. Is that bluster? Is he just performing or is he serious?
Netanyahu is playing on a card that is not tribal, in the sense that yes, there is this kind of consensus in the Israeli public that without taking over Rafah, then the war cannot be over, and that winning over Hamas is impossible without Rafah. He has the support. Whether he has a support for a real outright confrontation with the American administration, I doubt it. I doubt it. We have seen with Bush in 91 that when the U.S. put pressure on Israel, Shamir, who is even more right-wing than Netanyahu, went to Madrid and participated in this peace conference with a Jordanian-Palestinian delegation sitting for the first time with Palestinian representatives in the history of Israel. So I think if it will come to a full-blown confrontation with the U.S., the Israeli middle class, which is still the majority in Israel, will hesitate to follow Netanyahu in this route. They do support the invasion of Rafah. Most of the Israeli public do support it. But if the price is a full-blown confrontation with the U.S., more difficult.
Of course, he could be betting that Biden is just bluffing and he's not going to do anything if they invade.
Yes. I think Netanyahu is betting there. You know, we have seen Biden coming to Israel, I think it was a week or 2 weeks after October 7th, and warning Israel against doing what the U.S. did in Afghanistan and Iraq, warning against invading Gaza and occupying it. And Netanyahu, you know, heard him and did the opposite. And Biden continued to supply arms and supply this this international political umbrella that I talked before. Maybe Netanyahu is thinking that Biden is bluffing. At the last moment, he will say, okay, take Rafah, but do this before and do that, and but you can take Rafah. Maybe Netanyahu is betting on that, and he knows quite well the American arena, and maybe he's right. You may tell me better what is the atmosphere in liberal America and the Democratic Party and the Biden administration, if they are really fed up with Netanyahu and don't want to are not ready to put up with this anymore. And, you know, and Schumer's speech certainly indicated that there is such an atmosphere in the U.S., but maybe, you know, if there will be this confrontation, maybe Biden will be the guy that will withdraw at the last moment.
Yeah, I mean, there's within the Democratic Party, there's a growing discontent with the unconditional support of Israel, a growing support for the Palestinian cause, especially among younger people. American opinion on Israel isn't what it once was, and I'm not sure Biden is fully adapted to that. The Democratic Party right now is very divided on this.
Yeah, but the fact that Biden supported more or less Schumer and said that, you know, his speech was in the right direction, you know, indicates that maybe something has changed. But Netanyahu is betting, certainly is betting. My intuition is that he will not go into Rafah, but I was mistaken many times in this war. Because of the American pressure, maybe other countries that are threatening with the military embargo, but also maybe the military itself. Because the military itself, you have to understand that once Israel takes Rafah, Israel will control effectively the whole of the Gaza Strip, because it will control all the entrance to Gaza. And it will practically will be forced to take responsibility, even civil responsibility, over the Gaza Strip, over the lives of 2.3 million Palestinians. And it will be on the army to do it. And the army really hates to do it. So I think this may be also a consideration that in the last minute, Netanyahu will give up.
That was Maren Rappaport, a writer and editor for 972 Magazine and Local Call. You're listening to Behind the News on Jacobin Radio. My name is Doug Henwood, back after a musical break.
As I walk this wicked world, searching for light in the darkness of insanity, oh yeah, I ask myself, is all hope gone? Is there only pain, hatred, and misery? And each time I feel like this inside, there's one thing I wanna know. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? What's so funny about peace, love, understanding?
Son of Nick Lowe doing a song he wrote that Elvis Costello made famous, What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding, a Behind the News favorite. It was performed live on KGSR-FM Austin in 1995. Next, mental distress among the young. The other day I read a review of Abigail Schreier's new book, Bad Therapy. Her previous book was, by most accounts, a transphobic screed. I didn't read it, nor will I read the new one, because she seems like a terrible person and life is short. There was a review in Compact by the sociologist Frank Furedi, which recounted some of the points of Schreier's new book and added a few of his own. I thought these ideas were in wide enough circulation that it was worth a consideration. Furedi, by the way, is the guru of a formation that originated as the Socialist Workers' Party, UK edition, no relation to ours, which prided itself on its contrarian positions like opposing the 1985 miners' strike. That SWP eventually morphed into the libertarian website and conference sponsor, Spiked, that has gotten some funding from the right-wing Koch money spout. Here with that consideration is Jameson Webster, the psychoanalyst and writer, who's been on this show several times in the past. Her most recent book is Disorganization and Sex. Jameson Webster. The Zoomers are reporting high levels of mental distress. Now, you've written that these signs and symptoms are telling us something about our society. It seems these things are not necessarily things conservatives want to hear, so they're blaming therapy culture. And this explanation that all this distress is somehow iatrogenic, a product of the therapy culture. Taking, physician, heal thyself a few steps further. But one of the arguments I've seen, Frank Ferretti in Compact, for example, is that we're just turning all the normal troubles of childhood into pathologies. What do you make of that explanation? Is that what's going on?
Oof. I mean, everything is pathology on TikTok. I mean, whether celebrated or demonized, I suppose. So I don't know. It's a moment we're in where we like these labels or we like trying to isolate certain things and name them and eradicate them or celebrate them or find groups of people that identify with it also, from what I can see. As for childhood, yeah, I think parents are really scared and they kind of don't have communities that have passed down wisdom. So they go find a million answers in books and on Instagram or whatever. And then the first place they go is what's wrong. So we saw the beginning of this with, I think, ADHD. I think that's true. And then there was a market for it and there was a market for drugs. That was the beginning. There's a lot about autism these days, which is an ever widening scope. And in general, parents are on the lookout for what's wrong with the kids. It doesn't help that there's something up with the kids these days. There's a lot of visits to the emergency room. There's high suicidality. There's extreme behaviors like cutting and drug use that are happening earlier and earlier. So nobody knows what to do.
Now, what about the levels of mental disorder, distress? As I remember my youth, which is an increasingly long time ago, things do seem tougher now. But is my memory playing tricks on me, or has the level of mental distress really gotten more intense?
You know, there's this amazing study that I read about. I forget where it was, but they looked at the implementation of quote-unquote mindfulness in schools across the U.S. and Australia, and kids were worse off for taking these classes on mindfulness to address their anxiety than never having taken them at all. They reported more complaints. Why is that? I don't know, because they're being told they're anxious or they're being told anxiety is a problem. And then I think, yeah, they start to think about it and it's a problem. It's always been a problem of childhood, however. Being a child is not fun. I had this discussion with my partner and he was like, come on, being a child is great fun. I'm like, no, that's what we look back on nostalgically and think. It's tough to be a child.
It must be tough being the partner of a psychoanalyst, though.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. I'm like, yeah, that's fun. Childhood's great. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, it's both things. I mean, it can be immense fun. It can be immensely distressing. I mean, both those things are true at the same time, aren't they?
Both those things are true. I mean, there's like an immediacy and a kind of sensorial pleasure of childhood that we lose a lot of contact with. But things are really distressing. I mean, remember like sand in your shoes and like bugs in your food. I mean, these things can like throw you over the edge.
Yeah. But then there, it does seem, we look with envy at their, what seems to be their uncomplicated joy. And those are the moments, I guess, we just inflate to be the whole experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Kids have access to information that we certainly did not have. And there's an interesting question about what that's doing. And kids at school, and I know this because I see kids in treatment, talk to each other about their supposed mental illnesses. That did not happen. I mean, all of that was much more stigmatized when I was young, which isn't to say that destigmatizing it isn't a good thing. It is a good thing, but we're still in the middle of trying to figure things out. So there don't feel as much of a stigma around the question of what it means to be in distress, and they'll talk about it more readily, which is a good thing. But there's also an excessive talking about it without being able to address it that people are still very, very scared of. No matter what's out there, to actually speak with your child about their distress, parents have a real hard time doing it. They obviously know what's going on, so you need to tell them more. And you never see people hit a wall like this. It's unbelievable.
What you say about kids who go through mindfulness training reminds me, I've seen some studies showing that people who go through diversity training actually end up having more racist and homophobic and sexist thoughts than they did without the diversity training. So should we just not draw attention to these things?
Well, It's a question of education, which is much longer than a training, I think, is part of the problem. One of the things I was said about the study was, okay, so you spent a couple weeks telling children about anxiety and then having them practice relaxation skills that they were supposed to do on home all alone, and they didn't do it. And so what good did that do? I mean, if it was going to be something that would become a practice over a period of time for them as a way of, I don't know, coping, managing anxiety, getting to know their anxiety, playing around with it, fine. But that wasn't what a training was. It was some pointing something out and then sending them off alone to supposedly do something that they didn't know whether that was good for them or not good for them, or if they wanted to do it or didn't want to do it. That to me sounds like a really bad idea. On the other hand, talking to kids about anxiety and working with them over a longer period of time, great. I have very, very young kids who come to see me that are anxious, and it gets better. It can get better. But it takes time, and it takes like a willing adult.
You mentioned the ADHD diagnosis, which has become ubiquitous, it seems, over the last decade or two. What is behind that? I mean, is it diagnosis inflation? Is there something about everyone blames the internet and smartphones? What's going on there exactly?
Oy, I mean, that's a tough one. All the ADHD identified people will be angry at me. I mean, I don't know. Attention's a funny thing. I wrote about this almost a decade ago in the New York Review of Books about Freud wasn't so fond of attention. He thought attention was overrated. He thought we were best when our attention lapsed because something was allowed to come out. Sometimes we can do things without any attention at all. Like when you read out loud, you sometimes keep reading and you don't even know what you're reading at that point in time. Like you have no attention for it. Or sometimes you go into the zone, as people like to say, where you have like hyper-focused attention, which plenty of ADHD people can do. And so there's all kinds of variety and phenomenological experiences of attention, but we only have two ideas these days, that one has correct attentional capacities and then one has disordered attention. And, you know, they don't like this either very much, but if you take amphetamines, well, you can, you know, clean the bathroom grouting with your toothbrush for 3 hours. I promise you, anyone can do it.
Freud, his collected works run to what, 23 or 27 volumes? I have them up on the shelf. He obviously spent a lot of time paying attention, pretty close attention to something.
But his ideal wasn't, I mean, even the attention of the analyst is an attention that drifts. You don't pay attention to every single word your patient's talking about. You split your attention, you let it drift, you come back, you get interested in why your attention left, you get interested in the moment in which it comes back. I mean, it's not some ideal of attention. Did he develop over time concentration that it takes for writing? Yes, but that's just a skill that takes time, which we also don't realize with kids. Kids are like, writing's hard. And they're like, maybe you have ADHD. Guess what? Writing's hard. It's taken me 30 years to learn how to sit down and write. 30 years. Freud did not start writing until he was 47, like
really
writing. Yes.
Turned out pretty productive in the remaining years. Now, as a former patient, I'm distressed to learn that the analyst doesn't always listen to every word.
I know. I'm sure that that's really distressing to hear. I saw this amazing quote by Adam Phillips where he said, the rage against other people not understanding or paying attention is the last vestige of rage at the mother for not hanging on your every word.
I think my mother paid too much attention to me sometimes, but that's a whole nother pathology. For Ready Review, he points to Dr. Spock, who is widely criticized for spoiling the boomers, as warning against insulating children from fear. And the ubiquity of safe spaces these days offers some support for this view that we're just a little bit too much concerned about safety. Are today's kids growing up in some kind of social equivalent of padded cells?
It's so mean to say that about kids these days. I mean, I as an undergraduate professor at one point, I've been through like the requirement for safe spaces and the trigger warnings, and I had to get used to all of this. And I really wondered why there were all this fear about encountering speech from another person that's going to be disturbing. But I think we're very disturbed by the influx of information and things seen very early, and kids are looking for ways to find how to titrate what feels overwhelming to them. And I think that that's their prerogative, and we should allow them to do it. At the same time, we do need help being disturbed. We need help allowing ourselves to be disturbed at certain points in time by things we don't want to hear. We also have to speak to other people who have different points of views. You can't only be in like a tribal situation, which is unfortunately the situation in this country where whatever is happening on with algorithms, we only end up wanting to hear like, and we're becoming ever more polarized. So there's something, I don't know, there's something amiss that we can on the one hand not make fun of them for what they want to require, and on the other hand, work with it.
I wasn't blaming the kids. I was blaming the grown-ups. But in any case,
they were. The Spock, the person who was blaming the kids for being insulated. Yeah.
Ah, yes. I'm speaking with the psychoanalyst and writer Jameson Webster. You did mention increased numbers of emergency room visits and increased suicidal thinking. What is that telling us? Where is that coming from?
I mean, in the New York Times piece where I looked back on some of my patients who came in as teenagers with anxiety and suicidality, I guess I was thinking about a crisis with respect to the meaning of life. There's a lot of feelings of nihilism, pointlessness, not wanting to have a family, the end of the world, climate crisis, catastrophic conditions, not being able to make more money than your parents made, not being able to find a meaningful job. I mean, you hear a lot of this, which is also repeated in the news. I don't know where the information's coming from with respect to the kids, but you hear this repeated. And there's a feeling of not looking forward to anything, which is what I found really distressing to hear. You know, there wasn't like even sex, drugs, and rock and roll, or I love my friends, I hate my parents, you know, that kind of old angst. There was really a feeling that everything's played out. And one of the things that I did hear in complaints about the parents is that they are hearing in their parents this sentiment. So if their parents are finding life meaningless, and then it's, you know, sort of reflected in the society around them, then where do you find an ideal? Which is important for all of us to feel like we have something to move towards or something to work for or something worth desiring. I can usually excavate an ideal out from under any melancholia as my job, but I did find it hard with the younger generation. I found it really, really hard to help them find or construct something that they wanted for themselves.
Now, these children are professional class parents, or is it across the social spectrum?
It's across the social spectrum. Yeah. And I've talked with colleagues and it, you know, I think that it is across the social spectrum. I mean, even the suicide statistics are across the social spectrum, with higher incidences amongst minorities as well and the poor. So it does really seem to be across the spectrum.
You could read this as kind of embodied social critique, that this is a society that's alienated, aimless, falling to pieces, and these are the individualized symptoms of it. I mean, is that an outlandish reading?
I don't think it's an outlandish reading at all. I don't think it's an outlandish reading, especially the extent that the more extreme behaviors like suicidality or various forms of acting out like cutting and whatnot have a lot to do with the support structures that a society has in place to keep us from having to fall in those directions. So, I, you know, this is the problem. This is where I get worried about all of the individual diagnoses, is that they miss the broader picture. And I don't want to create a kind of reactionary picture like the right, but a picture of something that we need to do for the benefit of future generations would be nice.
Everybody. Yeah, I mean, there's a society that's lost meaning. This is certainly a conservative critique. We don't believe in God anymore. You know, traditional values, everything was easier when we're more rooted. But there is, if you strip away some of the reactionary parts of that, there's a kernel there that's worth thinking about. There is no meaning apart from the dollar, it seems like.
And yes. Yeah.
But it's not like you can just go construct with ex nihilo.
No, which is, I you know, I feel old for some reason at this point. The generational divide is big at the moment, it feels like. I mean, people talk about the younger generations, and I've started to become someone who's doing that, which means that it's really going to be up to them at this point. I don't know. That's my feeling about it, is that it's their, it has to be their project.
Yeah. that's her, that's a child. She's constructing the moral future. You know, you are in the line of work where you have to treat these things as individual problems. But how can you bring a social dimension or understanding to what you do, since you just have, it's just you and a patient there in dialogue. Is there a way to widen out the experience to just recognize that these are social issues and not just someone's personal distress?
I think so. I mean, patients come and they really want diagnoses, and then they want you to tell them what to do because of the diagnosis that they want you to think that they have. And I don't give anything like that. And, you know, people still stick around, believe it or not, because they start to understand that you're listening in a very different way. And for me, symptoms are transgenerational. So I think a lot of work that you do in therapy, you construct their parents and their parents' parents, you know, without blame, with understanding the wider picture of why you landed in the way that you landed in the life that you didn't ask for. And I think that that does give a very, very rich picture of the social field. And then you also listen to what people have to say about the world very carefully, and you take it seriously, which I think is sadly a rare experience for still a lot of people. And this is why, you know, despite the fact that mental health has been quote unquote destigmatized, I don't see it giving a person a richer contextualization for their life. I don't see it providing them with a source of meaning, which was always the psychoanalytic goal. Like, your symptom had a meaning and a place and spoke to something that was bigger than you.
But now it's all neurotransmitters.
Exactly. Exactly.
In that New York Times piece from now a couple of years ago, you write about identity issues. And it's interesting, we're talking constantly about identity politics, positively or negatively. But identity and Erikson's use of identity, it's a way of linking an individual's life and psyche to larger social structures. So what about identity? Is it harder to find one these days, even though we're talking about it all the time?
I think it's definitely harder. It was always hard for some, where they had what, you know, some like to call a negativized identity. For example, if you were a racial minority, you were just not white. But that was still an identity, it's a counter identity. And nowadays it feels like a lot of whatever power a dominant identity or the counter identities that were formed in relationship to it have been eviscerated. And I tended not to like the term identity. Psychoanalysis liked more fluidity and more ambiguity than the word identity seems to hold. But I was surprised in reading Erikson, who sounds very mid-century psychoanalysis, to find that his idea of identity in terms of the society being able to grant you a place, to feel like you have a place, whatever it meant to be American to you. It didn't have to be the dominant idea, but it meant that you could find a place somehow, whatever that would be. And he prophesized that with the kind of forces that were at work, including capitalism, but also the increase in the kind of melting pot and diversity, and then the sea changes that were going to take place in terms of women's rights and rights for minorities, that this was going to be a much more difficult project, identity. And he hoped that we would be up to the task of helping people have what he called a measure of dignity. That's also how he thought of identity, was like a measure of dignity in a life. He says, otherwise we were going to be in really big trouble. We were going to have more symptoms, more suicidality, and more delinquency.
What about the climate crisis? Do your younger patients, does that really penetrate their psyche deeply, that there is no future?
It does. I've been trying to think about what it means. I mean, Freud has this really funny idea that even in trying to be responsible for something like a world catastrophe, it's a rationalization because we can't really face up to death. So it's another way of shirking responsibility. So to scream like we're all going to die is still denial fueled. So I've been trying to think of what it means that these young people are saying, you know, the world is over. You know, we've killed all the species. There's no more fish. I don't want to have children. I don't want to propagate. I don't want to make money. I don't want to pollute anymore. I want to leave no trace. And this kind of will to disappear, you know, and there is something in it, like the idea of disappearing before you're disappeared.
Well, that's sort of a symbolic suicide, isn't it?
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's where I was going.
But it does seem ubiquitous. I mean, I just casual conversations with younger people who just think there is no future. It's terrifying to think that. I'm an old person. The future is probably not that long for me, but, you know, to hear young people say these things, it's very distressing. But this is the world we've left them.
It is. I mean, and my friend Alyssa Martyr in an article called Ecocide wrote about the fact that, you know, every day in the news, there's new species goes extinct, you know, the world will end, and it's a headline amongst other headlines. And how can this just be news? If we actually take it seriously, how can it just be a headline that we encounter every day? I mean, I think this is the conundrum that they face. So I don't blame them for wanting to turn up the volume, right? Because, you know, if you're a young child and you think, well, how can this be news? It's not news. If this is real, then they're trying to make it more real in their upset about it.
It seems to me the message of all this is that these issues that are presented as issues of mental health are really also at their base issues of social health. And it's kind of hard to understand these things fully without fully understanding the social dimensions, but nothing in our society or practice is geared towards doing that.
Nothing's geared towards doing that. I agree. And then we don't, I mean, it's not in terms of just being geared to socially kind of take up these issues on the other hand. And then it's we're not even geared to individually take them up. And so everything is on our individual shoulders to understand what's wrong with us, to understand what's wrong with the world, to fix the world, to fix ourselves. can you imagine? Can you, you know, like all of a sudden waking up and this is your responsibility alone? So I think the huddling together is where a lot of the comfort takes place, which I think that people are doing. I think they're huddling up.
In what sense do you mean that?
Like with their friends who feel like your friends who feel sick, or your friends who have a diagnosis, or, you know, in complaining and in feeling unwell and in being openly distressed. And friends get behind each other. I mean, this is a lot of what's happening in school and why people are so upset, because they're like, well, this is contagious. They're all making each other worse. But I think that they're trying to find community and comfort that we don't offer to them.
That was the psychoanalyst and writer Jameson Webster. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Domenico Scarlatti's sonata K-182, performed by Scott Ross, a piece that might restore at least some temporary equanimity to the universe. Till next week, bye.